Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Ryan Patrick Jones.
And I'm Christina Song.
And I'm Olamide Alanion.
It's Thursday, February the 15th at 5:01 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today's show features Globe and Mail and Vancouver Sun City Politics reporter Frances Beulah. Frances has been reporting on the city's Northeast False Creek plan over the past 2+ years and will walk us through Tuesday's City Council approval of the existing plan and why that plan is far from the last we'll hear on this redevelopment.
After that, Democracy Watch turns to Saturday's Colton Bushy rally in front of Vancouver's CBC building. We'll interview Ronnie Dean Harris, a Coast Salish activist who spoke at the rally, as well as Indigenous justice expert Dr. David Millward, who joins us live from Manitoba. After that, we will be ending the show with some of our original reporting from yesterday's Memorial March in honor of Canada's missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls.
But first, the headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. Vancouver is deemed the second costliest city in Canada for childcare in a study by Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. The median fee for infants is $1,360. Median fee for toddlers is $1,292. The costs are much similar across the board in Greater Vancouver area. So 95% of all facilities have wait lists, meaning that even if you could afford this childcare, there's often not a place for your child.
And yeah, so childcare activists insist that BC must adopt a $10 a day program, similar to Quebec's. Premier Horgan signaled in a speech last week that childcare would be a priority for his government, and he has pledged to provide better support for childcare. However, he has put forward no firm plans as of yet, and has not yet put forward a budget for such a program. The BC government was slated to meet with the federal government last week to discuss funding for childcare programs, but the feds canceled at the last minute, saying that there was a scheduling conflict.
However, the cancellation came amidst the dispute amongst BC, Alberta, and Ottawa about Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain pipelines and the related trade dispute between the provinces.
And BC wine, am I right?
Yeah. And bitumen. So.
Yeah, cool. I thought you were about to say something. This weekend, former UBC athlete was tackled, tasered, and arrested by Vancouver Police Department. Early on Sunday morning, CTV News reported on the incident. The situation involved former Thunderbird, that's an athlete at the University of British Columbia, Jameel Moore-Williams, and about seven officers from the Vancouver Police Department. The report featured a video which begins with Moore Williams claiming that he was targeted because he was a black man crossing the street. The situation escalates as multiple officers pull Moore Williams to the ground during the altercation. Moore Williams appears to be kicked, punched while he's on the ground, and another officer stands a few feet away and shoots a taser at him. Moore Williams spent the rest of his weekend in police custody, and he was given a jaywalking ticket, and he was also charged with two counts of obstruction of justice. The VPD, Vancouver Police Department, released a statement denying that Moore Williams was targeted because he was black. Moore Williams' friend Malcolm Lee was with him before the incident, and he recorded the video footage that we see on the CTV website. Both of them were members of the Thunderbirds that won 2015-2016 Vanier Cup. So, yeah.
All right. Democracy Watch will continue to follow this story closely as it develops, and we will report more information as it becomes available. And those are this week's headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. We're going to take a short break and be back with reporter Frances Beulah to talk about the Vancouver City Council's passage of the Northeast False Creek Plan. Stay with us.
What newspapers and magazines did you regularly read to stay informed and to understand the
I've
world?
Read most of them, again, with a great appreciation for the press, for the media.
What ones specifically?
All of them.
Want to know more than Sarah Palin? Join CITR's Current Affairs Coordinator Alex DeBoer every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. in room 2514 in the AMS Nest to learn best practices for covering local current affairs topics for radio. The weekly training sessions will cover writing for radio, determining newsworthiness, media ethics, interviewing, writing balanced stories, and more. Initiative to give more voice to local women artists and musicians. Mixtapes is a Vancouver-based biannual mixtape featuring women-identified musicians and sound artists from the Pacific Northwest. The Spring 2018 edition will be coming out on May 10th, with all proceeds going to the Downtown Eastside Women's Shelter. Women-identified artists are invited to send their submissions to btchtapes@gmail.com. The release fundraiser will be held on May 10th at the Redgate Review Stage, featuring artists selected for this edition of the cassette. For her latest release, The Valley. Come out Wednesday, February 28th to see Betty Hu with special guests at the Imperial in Vancouver. Get tickets and more information at timbreconcerts.com. Metatron presents Ethereal Shadowland, their first official Vancouver reading. They will be featuring the poignant voices of Metatron and Vancouver-based poets. Come listen to the poetic musings of Adele Barclay, Asia Moore, Ashley Obscura, Brad Casey, Ivana Besanovsky, Leah Horlick, and Chazia Hafiz Ramji at Paperhound on Tuesday, February 13th at 7 p.m.
Tune in to African Rhythms every Friday from 7:30 to 9 o'clock with your host, David Love Jones, as he plays a heavyweight selection of classics from the past, present, and future. This includes jazz, soul, hip-hop, Afro-Latin, funk, and eclectic Brazilian rhythms.
Lots of people, they take it like a game.
It could be global, trance, spoken word, rock, the usual and the weird, or it could be something different. Oral Tentacles, Thursdays 12 to 6 a.m. at CITR 101.9 FM.
Robots need love too.
This is Dan Mangan, and you are listening to CITR 101.9. And surrounding
universities. They want to be loved by you.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah. Explosions.
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live bands, swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
Here we go. And we're back with Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 101.9 FM. We just heard headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland, and we are now joined by Frances Beulah, who's a local politics reporter. She's written for the Globe and Mail, Vancouver Sun, many other publications. She's also a professor of journalism at UBC School of Journalism, and my former teacher and Ryan Patrick Jones's current teacher. So, yeah, we're very lucky to have her on the line to discuss Tuesday's passing of the Northeast False Creek Plan. So I'll let Ryan take it.
Thank you for joining us, Frances.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. After that long resume, it's time not to talk about anything, but okay, let's
go. We're honored.
All right, so the Northeast False Creek Plan was passed by City Hall on Wednesday. Can you give us just a broad outline of the most important parts of the plan?
So, sure. And so, first of all, people should understand this was a policy document. So there's still more parts of this to come to finalize it. There have to be rezonings and so on. So things can change. But it's a pretty big plan because it's for this whole area that in the Northeast Falls Creek area that's a part of downtown that sits, just to the east of downtown, between downtown and Chinatown. And it's eventually supposed to house anywhere between 10 and 15,000 people, have the biggest park outside of Stanley Park in the downtown, have a new kind of waterfront, very active with lots of shops and restaurants, which is different for Vancouver. We tend to have what they call the spandex seawall. Where it's beautiful to walk, but there's no commercial activity. It's meant to, in the planning of it, to sort of address some of the historic wrongs done to the Chinese, Black, and Indigenous communities. It's going to involve taking down the viaducts and reconfiguring the lower road. So that's just the beginning. So you can see there's a lot involved in it.
Yeah. Right. So, and can you just talk about those two measures to redress those historical injustices to the Chinese and Black community?
Right. So, a lot of people don't know it, but there actually was a fairly significant Black community downtown in the early part of the 20th century. And if you look at old films of the area, you can actually see it by looking at the people playing, you know, the kids playing in the backyards and so on. And they tended to live near Chinatown, near the train station, because a lot of people actually worked on the train system. And they were pretty much eradicated when the viaducts were built, because the two blocks where they concentrated were where the eastern end of the viaducts comes down. And it's why there's been a little shrine for years across the street there that said, you know, Jimi Hendrix's aunt used to cook, you know, in a restaurant here.
Oh, interesting. And so,
So part of what's happening is an attempt to, you know, you can't obviously, you know, the Black community in Vancouver isn't all suddenly going to move down there if housing opens up, but some kind of acknowledgement of it, encouragement of people to use it as a hub by creating certain kinds of businesses and housing that might attract them. And then Chinatown, of course, was also very affected, had a lot of homes expropriated and destroyed as the city was putting in the freeway, and also the Indigenous community, like the sort of the flats around Falls Creek, was a place where, you know, the Indigenous community did used to have sort of base camps or whatever.
So I know that there is a community center planned to be built for the Black community, the Hogan's Alley Memorial. In terms of the Indigenous community, do you know if there's any formal acknowledgement?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that has come about so far is a motion that Councillor Andrea Reimer put forward, actually, as they were approving this, which is maybe to give the area an Indigenous name.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
All right.
That's about all. No special anything planned in terms of amenities or housing or services.
Okay, and there were some amendments made, from what I understand, on Wednesday. Can you tell us, were there any significant ones that were...
There were so many, it's actually a little hard to remember them all. I think it went up to L or M or something.
Oh, my goodness.
That.
All right,
but,
yeah.
Some of the significant ones were that, so the city owns a couple of blocks of the land down there, right on either side of Main Street. The rest of the land in Northeast Falls Creek, and under the viaduct, and the rest of the land in Falls Creek is owned by three major owners, Concord Pacific, Canadian Metropolitan Properties, who own Plaza of Nations, and then PAVCO, like, you know, the agency of the BC government that owns BC Stadium. So the city owns two blocks, and there was a motion that the housing there on the city block should be 100% rental, and 70% of that should be subsidized. So that's the staff had me aiming for 30% subsidized. So that's quite a big step up, because they had, you know, envisioned about maybe 1,000 apartments there. So that was one. One was to have more consultation with the Chinese community, and some amendments were put in, you know, to have $30 million put into the overall plan to help refurbish the Chinese Cultural Center. For example, the indigenous name was an amendment. There were other amendments about, you know, the road system and the, you know, how the road system should work. Adrian Carr from the Green Party tried to put forward an amendment to address the whole issue of the three tall towers in the whole project, which will go into Vancouver's sacred view cones.
Right.
For those people who don't know them, they're, you know, protected views that have been established by the city. So three of the towers are supposed to, you know, go somewhat into those view cones, and there's been some controversy over it, and Adrian Carr tried to have that re-looked at. That was not accepted by the majority on council.
Right.
So those are some of them.
So in terms of the subsidized housing, so you said there was an increase in one of the amendments was an increase in subsidized housing?
Well, they're going to look at it.
Okay.
I mean, this is all tentative. Nothing
right.
is chiseled in stone. So they said in the future planning, as you go forward and keep planning this area, can we see if there's a way to get to 70% subsidized apartments on the city lands rather than just 30%.
So do you know if this, the passing of this plan with these amendments, though they're still tentative, do you know if it's being seen as a victory by Hogan's Alley Society activists and Chinese-Canadian activists?
So the Hogan's Alley activists really like it, and they came out and very much supported it, something I don't see very often at city council, is
yeah.
enthusiastic, happy people.
Yeah.
but they were very much in support of it. They really felt that this was the first time ever, in some ways, in the Black community's history in Vancouver, that they'd been pulled together and offered an opportunity to be involved in city planning and to connect with each other. So they were very much in support. The Chinese community was not so much. They felt that they had not had the same level of consultation. They felt that parts of the plan would lead to them being cut off, you know, because there's roads being reconfigured and shut, you know, sort of blocked and so on. And so they were worried that traffic was not going to, or, you know, traffic of various kinds was not going to be able to get into Chinatown to actually shop there.
Right.
So they felt a little bit not as consulted.
Hmm. All right. So now that the plan has council approval, what comes next?
In August, the staff have to produce, which is going to be hard because actually council doesn't meet in August and everyone's off. But anyway, around August, staff are supposed to come up with an implementation plan and a financial plan, because the big tricky thing in all of this is that the city is saying if this has to be a self-financed neighborhood. So they want $1.7 billion worth of amenities in there, new community centers, a new park, new seawall, all kinds of different subsidized housing, and so on. But that has to be paid for through this area, financing it through density, which essentially means developers get extra density and turn some money of their profits back to the city to pay for these things.
Interesting. So the city's not really budgeting any of its own money for it?
No, it is budgeting some of its own money. But it's not going to sort of go into general revenues or put through tax increases in order to finance this. So, you know, it's essentially going to come from the city selling some of its land. Like, it's going to sell the land it currently owns under the viaduct to the developers. That allows them to assemble coherent packages down there. It'll keep its two blocks around Main, but it will sell some of its land, and then it'll get some through density, you know, the density or the developer fees and so on. And I'm not sure. Like, that's what I'm waiting for, is the financial report to see where is this $1.7 billion going to come from.
Yeah, that is something that's interesting. And So how long do you think until it will be completed, this area, this neighborhood?
Well, everyone's saying 20 years. But apparently the first, you know, the first rezonings might start as early as this spring. You know, I'd be surprised if a building goes up earlier than, say, 3 years from now. And it's going to be tricky because they're reconfiguring the roads at the same time as the building is going to happen. So they have to do it in a certain order in order to not have a building going up and the road next to it is disappearing or something like that, or being moved.
Right, yeah, lots to coordinate. Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time, Frances.
Okay, keep following it. Not dead yet.
Yeah, totally. We'll probably check in with you again over the next 20 years. And,
okay, I'll be here, sitting right at the media table at City Hall.
Awesome, yeah.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah,
thanks
so much. So that was Frances Beulah, UBC journalism professor and local city politics reporter. Stay tuned. We're about to take a short break, and then we're going to go to Vancouver's rally over the acquittal of Gerald Stanley in the shooting death of Colton Bushi that happened on Saturday in front of the CBC downtown. So we'll be right back with more Democracy Watch after this short break.
The world is a better place because of Kim Kardashian's empire,
Cheetos,
fleece material,
and Discorder.
It's a local independent music magazine from CITR.
Which means that we can print whatever we heckin' want.
Album and live show reviews, interviews with artists, and sweet illustrations grace our pages.
And even you, listener, can contribute.
Just visit CITR.ca/Discorder/contribute.
You can grab it around town or read it at Discorder.ca.
Forever local and forever free.
Member of CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 for discounts in Kitsilano and around UBC at
On the Fringe Hair Design, Rufus Guitar Shop, Stormcrow Ale House, The Bike Kitchen, UBC Bookstore, Australia Boot Company, and so many more.
And we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just spoke to reporter Frances Beulah about the passage of the Northeast False Creek Plan by the Vancouver City Council. Now we will turn our attention to a story that is dividing Canadians. People across this country are grappling with the serious issue of whether or not the Canadian justice system is biased against Indigenous people after the acquittal of Gerald Stanley, a Saskatchewan farmer, in the shooting death of Colton Bushi. Bushi was a 22-year-old Cree man who lived in the Red Pheasant First Nation Reserve outside Battleford, Saskatchewan. Bushi was shot and killed by farmer Gerald Stanley, a white male, after an altercation on Stanley's farm in August 2016. Stanley was found not guilty of the shooting on Friday by an all-white jury. The decision has sparked outrage in Indigenous and non-Indigenous communities in this country. A series of rallies were held across the country, including in downtown Vancouver, to show support for the Justice for Colton movement. Hundreds of protesters gathered outside CBC Vancouver's building on Georgia Street Sunday to express outrage over the acquittal of Stanley. Demonstrators gathered for over an hour to chant, sing songs, and to listen to speakers. A second rally was held outside the constituency office of federal MP and Justice Minister Jody Wilson-Raybould on Tuesday, calling for reforms to the legal system. We have a clip here from one of the speakers at the Vancouver rally. This is Ronnie Dean Harris.
We live in a society, a colonial society, in which all of us are victims. If the system is broken itself, each and every one of us within it are victims, whether we are Indigenous or not.
And Democracy Watch spoke to Ronnie Dean Harris today, a Coast Salish activist and a hip-hop artist by the name, goes by the stage name Oz 12, and we're going to play that interview with you right now.
Our guest is Ronnie Dean Harris. Ronnie is a Coast Salish activist and hip-hop artist. He was a speaker at Sunday's Colton Bushi rally, which took place in front of the CBC in downtown Vancouver. Welcome, Ronnie, and thank you for joining us. You were one of the speakers at Saturday's Colton Bushi rally, which happened in protest of the non-guilty verdict for Gerald Stanley, who shot Colton. And so I was wondering if you could just start off by telling us a little bit about your role in that rally. You were a speaker. Were you also an organizer?
No, I was just asked to speak there by the organizer, Geraldine Webster, a.k.a. JB, the First Lady.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't plan on speaking there, but they'd asked me to go, so I went and shared what I could share there anyways.
Yeah, okay, cool. How do you think the rally went? Was there a good turnout?
Yeah, it was really great. I mean, it's always comforting to see non-Indigenous allies, you know, gather for these things. Obviously, as Indigenous people, we've been, you know, been gathering when we can for a lot of these issues for a long time. I've been, you know, somewhat active in the scene here in Vancouver in different capacities, you know, since the 90s or something like that. So for something like this that has affected our community, it was really lovely to see a good number of people out. You know, you can always do more, but, you know, these are quick reactions to a stimulus that comes to us. So you can't expect everybody to always be out for the things, but it's nice to see people engaged.
Right, yeah, because the rally was put together quite quickly because it was the day following the verdict.
Yeah. I feel like time is really, there was like a really weird, interesting time shift that happened. Like, like 72 hours after, it felt like it was a week, you know?
Really?
So just because so much emotion and gone out and information, confrontations, information coming out. So it seemed like it was going really fast. And it's really only been like 5-6 days. Has it been a week? Maybe it's been a week or something like that, you know?
6 days, I think.
Yeah, so we haven't even hit 7 days on this verdict. So, and look at the actions that have happened. So time is going really fast because now is the time, while this is open, while we're talking about it, to do this work and really try to create some sort of positive change from what's going on.
Right, yeah. And so would you say, since you've been an activist going back to the 90s, that today in 2018 you see more non-Indigenous allies come out to support Indigenous causes?
Yeah, I mean, okay. I've talked about it and with other news agencies recently, but like I was cognizant for the Oka crisis in the summer of 1990.
Wow.
So, you know, I faced physical violence against my person because I was Indigenous and in a small town that I was living in. I've experienced that violence. I watched those warriors humiliatingly have to give up and be arrested on television, live feed, CBC. I witnessed, and that wakes you up in a way. I guess the term is woke now. I guess maybe that was my woke moment. So I've understood from a very early age that I've not I don't have the same rights as the people around me that are not Indigenous. And I've always been aware of that. And my, my family, my grandparents and my mother were very instrumental in making sure that I was educated to what my rights were and what the work was. There's always a constant work going on for us to revitalize our culture and to assert our sovereignty and nationhood. So I've always known it as to be part of this work. And it's really great to see that other people within the terms of reconciliation, I guess, now, which is a huge part of it, that people are going, okay, well, let's help out with this work. Let's contribute. Let's, you know, it's really nice to see that. And we don't feel quite as alone as we used to, you know what I mean? Like when in the summer of 1990, I remember just feeling so helpless, you know, and like, there's no one to comfort us. It was just us in a small town, the only Indians in town. And so it felt really lonely. And so now I can go out and have people who contribute and we really, and they really seem to care. So it's nice. It's better.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, you're talking about how you've always known that you have to assert your own rights and sovereignty because the Canadian government and society won't do that for you. And now you see more non-Indigenous Canadians maybe standing up for Indigenous people. But what more can settlers do, like, to support Indigenous people? Like, do you have any thoughts on how there could be better allyships?
Yeah, you know, I do work in schools as well. I run a program called Reframing Relations, which takes a non-Indigenous and an Indigenous facilitator into classrooms, and we talk about reconciliation. So, you know, we were working in schools for a while, but then identifying that it's, you know, it's the teachers that need a lot of this work now. So what I tell teachers and what I tell students is that to just be very honest with your understanding around these relationships we're rebuilding. Be really honest with your understanding of the what reconciliation is and also what the work of Indigenous people asserting sovereignty within an unceded territory means. And start below your feet. Start below your feet and spiral outwards. Understand the Indigenous people around you and the struggles that they're going through and the work that they're doing, whether it's revitalizing culture, revitalizing language, doing casework for sovereignty, nationhood, fights for water, salmon, watersheds, wetlands, you know, all the things that concern us that we put our energy out to is to try to understand it. And even if you don't understand it, like, really try to put it on your heart and mind that we do these things because it affects our life, our vitality, and our future. And what we're going through right now is a very divisive place where it seems like we're being pit against each other in to war.
Right?
Where it's like red and white. But these are symptoms of a systematic division in which we are going through. So we have to look past this ancient, antiquated system that has put us together to figure out how we're going to build this future together. We've been charged with the responsibility of this thing called reconciliation, but before we get there, we're going to have to recognize who we are and what we're playing for on this field and make sure that we have space for all of us to move forward.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting that you talk about the first step to reconciliation and being a better ally, being honesty, because I listened to BC Almanac, and I don't know if you heard that episode where they had call-ins from around the province about this verdict on Colton Bushi, and it was actually incredibly disturbing. I guess it's not surprising, but a lot of non-Indigenous Canadians, particularly white Canadians, who were very, very racist, but definitely didn't know they were being racist, like, would say things like, this one man was like, well, this one thing in the media that's really frustrating is that no one's talking about how Colton and his friends were drinking and they were trying to steal a car. And he's like, of course it's terrible he was shot, but, like, this was the situation. And it's like, he thought that he was making those two distinct points and not implying that he deserved to die because he was drinking and stealing, you know?
Right.
And so if the first step is honesty, like people stopping and looking at what they're saying and what they believe and sort of unpacking it, because like it seems like so much of the problem is that people don't even realize that they're racist.
No, it's because, I mean, and we have to be compassionate with that. You know what I mean? Like the framework of white supremacy as a global structure is about genetic survival. So at the heart of it is this fear of genetic annihilation. So what are these spheres that are creating this multi-generational systemic protective situations? It's like a fort mentality. You go in, you set up some walls, you keep the saber-toothed tigers, the bears, and the savages out. And this has been multi-generationally taught in our schools, in the education system, in the media, in the movie, the narrative of movies. It's always cowboys versus Indians, and this is because Canada is a colonial state. Yeah. Even the national anthem, which says "We stand on guard for thee," is a declaration that this is a military occupation in which the citizens of Canada are standing officers within this military occupation to hold the state of Canada away from the savages.
Right.
So, from the inception of this country, which is a colonial occupation, that mindset is deeply set in the fabric of who we are as Canada. And so the idea of a young man on your property practicing sovereignty, maybe having a few beers, is threatening to what a mainstream Canadian man is. So this man felt he was protecting his ground from the savages. This is imprinted in the nature of who we are as a society. So the fact that even society has a hard time with leveling with this comes from deep-seated knowledge and teachings that we've been instilled with. So we have to really challenge that and rupture that thinking and humanize it in a new way. Also by us listening across the table as well to see what we can provide so that this relationship can move forward. Because right now it's just going to be red and white. You did this, I did that, he said, she said. It's horrible right now. So we need to really like figure out what we're going to do to move peacefully forward, because it's not getting any better. The Trumpism down south is not helping out in any way. So we really have to stand up and challenge these systems and challenge these fears and misunderstandings between us as cultures.
Right. Yeah, totally. And so in terms of challenging those systems in place, how much of a priority do you think changing Canada's current justice system and court system should be? Should that be top of the list? Because a lot of people, as a result of this verdict, are saying the Canadian court system should be incorporating more Indigenous-centered practices of justice and, of course, have a more diverse jury. There's various theories as to how that should be done. But, yeah, what kind of priority do you think changing the court system should be given?
Yeah, that's at the top of it. And you know, the justice system has been changing. I mean, my mom studied criminology when I was in high school, so she made me take the LSAT when I was like 14 years old.
Whoa.
She made me aware of the Young Offenders Act. Now we have things like the Gladue case, the Gladue decision, which can affect court cases based upon Indigenous ancestry, life experience. You know, these are antiquated systems with old laws that, and the times change. The status of who we are in relationships has to change as well. I don't really have all the answers for the legal stuff. I have legal people I'm talking to about some of the ideas, and I'm reminded by a dear friend of mine who is a juris doctor in law that this is not about the court of a public opinion. At the heart of this is important casework that the family is going through. Surrounding that now is the catalyst and the conduit to create systemic change within the legal system. And it has to be regional. It has to be regional change. I mean, the Attorney General of the province stayed those charges or the lack thereof. So looking at the status of the rurality of this place, the relations between Indigenous people, I've been to North Battleford. I've been to these areas. It's blatantly racist. I've lived in Saskatchewan. I know the racism there. I've been in back of cop cars. I've been on those rides. Like, we have to, unfortunately, because white supremacy and racism is kind of attached to egos and emotions, even mentioning racism really triggers non-Indigenous people.
Yeah.
So shifting the language to be more of a call-in instead of call-out and singling out, I think is important. I mean, we have frameworks for this. I mean, the civil rights movement went through it. There's been important work that's already been done to do these relations. So we just have to open up the bundle and really, like, look at the systemic changes. And it has to be regional. It just can't be a blanket solution for all Indians across the country, because we are many nations with many backgrounds.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Like, when I do reconciliation work, like, in schools or teaching stuff, like, the East Side has way different cosmological understanding than the West Side, and then the North and South, and then Vancouver and Surrey are all way different. So the fact that if you put one law on us out here in unceded territory, and then more laws out them, same laws for them out in treaty territory, and then you're going to have those dynamics. So it's complicated.
Yep.
It's going to be inconvenient for the future, but this is how we're going to build a better future, a better Canada, a better society, better relations between us both, so that all our kids, this is what it's about, so that our kids can grow up so they don't have to go through this, so they don't have to live in hatred, the hatred that we pass on to them. It's important for us to fix this so we don't pass it on to our kids. I don't want my little brother to have fears of this. I don't want him. He's six now. He's got 12 years or, you know, 20 years or something like that. You know what I mean? We need to make this better so that he doesn't go through these things.
Yeah.
And for our kids.
Absolutely.
I don't even have kids. I don't even know why I do this work sometimes. But I've got little brother, little sisters, nieces and nephews. This is for them. This is so that when they get older, our cultures can look across the table and create enterprise and save the land, save salmon, save water, protect the earth from it, so that we can thrive from it instead of fighting over these ancient, old, like, racism is old. This is like old, ancient news. Like, we need to, you know, really aim towards. So, I mean, I don't have all the answers, but that, from my understanding, I'm hoping that we can really create a better dialogue around it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I would love to dig more into some of the things you're saying. I think it's, like, really, really interesting, even talking about changing the language that we use to talk about this sort of white supremacy. Unfortunately, I have to leave it there because we have a bunch of content. But thank you so much for speaking with us, Ronnie. And if you get a chance to tune in today, please do so. Again, the show's at 5. We also will podcast it, so I'll email you the episode as well, so you have
it.
Yeah.
I'll put it on my network.
And that was Ronnie Dean Harris, a Coast Salish activist and hip-hop artist, as well as an educator. When he's doing his hip-hop, he goes by the stage name Oz12. Stay tuned. We're just going to go to a quick PSA break, a little bit of ads, and we'll be right back with Dr. David Millward, an associate professor of law at the University of Manitoba. We're going to speak about Indigenous justice and the trial of Gerald Stanley.
Sugoi.
Is Coco Hamamatsu talking about koi fish in a pond, or the youth at CITR and Discorder? Get info on your wares, services, or events directly to students, musicians, artists, and all the coolest cats from Bellingham to Squamish by advertising with CITR and Discorder, on air, in print, or online. This can be your reality if you email us at advertising@citr.ca or call 604-822-4342. Visit citr.ca for rates and packages.
Do you have any awareness of what's been happening with newspapers in the last 10 years?
Not at all.
I mean, truth is, I don't even get them anymore. I just read the news on my phone.
It's so much better and it's free.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The future of news media is in your hands. If you're interested in independent journalism and current affairs, CITR's News Collective is for you. Help hound down stories about diverse and underrepresented issues in the Lower Mainland for Democracy Watch, airing every Thursday at 5 p.m. Email volunteer@citr.ca to get involved.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke weed every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
Tired of the gender binary, gender policing, or just want to speak your truth?
Join CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective.
This group of radio makers is all about centering the voices, issues, concerns, and experiences of women identified, transgender, intersex, two-spirit, genderqueer, gender nonconforming, non-binary, and gender fluid folks and allies.
Anyone can join, no experience necessary.
Like the Gender Empowerment Collective on Facebook or email volunteer at citr.ca.
Our show, Intersections, airs Thursdays from 4 to 5 and features music, interviews, events, news, commentary, basically anything we care to talk about.
See you then.
And welcome back to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We are now about to speak to Dr. David Millward on the phone to talk about what reforms can maybe be implemented to help make the justice system more fair, especially when it comes to the treatment of Indigenous people. So Dr. Millward is an associate professor of law at the University of Manitoba. He's an expert in the fields of Indigenous justice, Indigenous rights, and the law of evidence, and he's also the author of Aboriginal Justice and the Charter. Welcome, Dr. Millward.
Thank you.
All right. So thanks so much for joining us. So basically, what we want to speak to today is, so there's been a history of discrimination against Indigenous people, both, you know, in the country, but also especially in the justice system in this country. Can you give us some examples of how this discrimination has played out historically?
Okay. So there have been times, for example, where you have, for example, wrongful convictions against Aboriginal peoples. Particular example is Donald Marshall, where somebody else did it, but even his own defense lawyers assumed he was guilty and didn't look into information that could have gotten him off. And then you have inordinate police attention on Aboriginal suspects of crime, and also Starlight Tours dumping them out in freezing weather without any jackets on. But then on the other side, where it's Aboriginal peoples who are the victims, you have, for example, police not taking it as seriously as in comparison to non-Aboriginal victims. And also, this example here with Gerald Stanley, where basically the jury let the person off, where there was some pretty strong evidence that suggested that Gerald Stanley did in fact murder Colton Bushy.
Right. So, yeah, I'd like to turn to the shooting death of Colton Bushy now. And so I'm actually here with my a fellow reporter, Aiden Tong.
Hi, Dr. Mm-hmm. Millard. One of the major criticisms in Gerald Stanley's case has been the use of peremptory challenges by Gerald Stanley's defense team. What is a peremptory challenge, and how is it used in their trial?
Okay. So there's two types of challenges. One is a challenge for cause, where there's a real concern that a juror is actually displaying bias or has the real potential for it, but you need some sort of information and permission from the judge. But if you have that, then you can do it without limitation. Peremptory challenges are different in the sense that each side gets a limited number. Now, for second-degree murder, that number would be 12 each. And either side can use peremptory challenges however they see fit, purely for strategical, tactical reasons, and they don't have to justify or explain themselves to anyone for how they use them.
So that seems like a lot. They have 12 each side?
Yes.
And so what's the historical reason for that? Is there, I'm sure that it's there for a reason.
Yeah. Well, historically, the idea was that if you were convinced, even if you couldn't quite meet the challenge for cause threshold, but you were still convinced that that person was going to turn on you or wasn't sympathetically disposed towards your case, it gave you an opportunity to craft a jury more to your liking, or at least exclude something that underneath you suspected was going to be outright.
Okay, and do we have some evidence, like how were peremptory challenges used in this trial?
Okay, now Aboriginal peoples have long suspected that peremptory challenges have been used against them when, for example, an Aboriginal accused is on trial and then the Crown uses them. That issue was brought to the fore of the Manitoba Justice Inquiry in 1991 and the Akabuchi Commission 2013, and now we have this trial. And we have Colton Bushy's family members sitting in the jury selection process, and they're seeing this for themselves. Anytime an Aboriginal person came up, the defense lawyer used a peremptory challenge on that person.
Oh, I see. And so another thing so you recently wrote an article in Maclean's magazine implying that this may have been a case of jury nullification. Can you explain what that is and how it would apply to the trial?
Okay, so what I'm talking about is where even if the jury has the law properly explained to them and the evidence might be actually be pretty strong in favor of guilt, the jury might, for various reasons, maybe based purely on its own sympathies and prejudices, just enter not guilty verdict, however strong the evidence of the prosecution may be. Now, having said that, we might suspect it, we might be prone to come to that conclusion in a given case, but we can't definitively prove it because jury's deliberations are protected by secrecy as a matter of law. We lawyers never have access to them. They can never become the foundation for an appeal, but at the same time, creating that safe space is a ripe field for jury nullification.
So your article asked whether indigenous approaches to justice should be incorporated into our legal system. What are some of the major differences between indigenous approaches and Western approaches?
Okay. Now, keep in mind, not a lot of Aboriginal peoples have actually used trials in the way that the Western society thinks of them. So in some respects, I'm thinking of in-between approaches. So, for example, and Australia has actually experimented with this, this idea where you pull up an Aboriginal witness, but you don't put him on the stand in front of everybody and have lawyers just grill him with cross-examination questions. Even non-Aboriginal peoples can be really uncomfortable with that whole prospect. So the idea, well, get him in some sort of private room and then just ask the person some simple questions, put him at ease, establishing a rapport, and if he's at ease and more comfortable, maybe the truth is more likely to come out. But at the same time, it's not adversarial. It's not that sort of right to confront that people in Western society are so used to or so familiar with.
Right. So I'm just wondering, what would a legal system look like that kind of incorporated some indigenous approaches into the existing system?
I admit it's somewhat speculative on my part. So if we actually tried to implement it, I don't know what it would actually definitively look like. Do I hope it would work out better? Well, of course I do. But it might actually look very different from Canadian legal processing. For example, it could occur, for example, in a gymnasium on the reserve instead of, an actual courtroom with the wooden benches and everything else.
All right. And so what are some other reforms that can be implemented to make the justice system more fair, especially when it comes to the treatments of Indigenous people?
Well, some ideas that I bandied about in my article, the easy one is to do away with parenting challenges altogether. And for anyone listening, it's not as world-turning a move as people might think it is, because for years, it's been decades since Great Britain and the United States have even bothered with using it. It's a historical artifact in both Britain and the United States. Another idea is actually having representative juries where people from various segments of the community have to be represented on a jury. That's a more difficult one because, people have difficult time serving on juries to begin with. You're taking them away from their jobs. Aboriginal peoples were having to travel from rural settings to urban centers to serve. That's an especial hardship for them. So that's a complex question. The other one I explored is, do we need to open up access to jury deliberations to inject, in case they actually do try to muck it up or they do engage in flawed reasoning, but at the same time, doing that means you take away the safe space and maybe juries are having to worry about public pressures or resentment. So these are complicated questions, but I suggest in my article that they need to be looked at.
All right, thank you. And I've just got one last quick question, although it's going to be a big one. Sure. So how much do you think the Gerald Stanley acquittal and the problem that it represents, how much do you think that is due to the system and how much do you think is due to systemic racism?
I think it's a mixture of both. And, racism is not an accusation I throw lightly, but the fact of the matter is first of all, you have a Crown expert who says there's nothing on the gun that says this hang fire action could have even occurred. But even if a hang fire occurred, hang fires occur in a fraction of a second. It's not where you pull the trigger and then car 5 minutes later, then the bullet comes out. That never happens. You've had other gun experts outside of the trial saying that. And also, in other jury trials where murder was the offense, oh, my gun accidentally went off. That's been hard sell to juries in other cases, and yet we don't see that skepticism here. And also, the bullet wound on the back of Colton Boshi's head, that's very indicative of somebody walking up and shooting him in the back of the head, execution style. So I do strongly suspect that societal racism was a factor here. But then you have these defects in the system itself, like peremptory challenges, which is a recipe for pretty much categorical 100% exclusion of Aboriginal persons from the jury. So I do think it's a mixture of the two.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Millward, for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You have a great day.
You too. Bye.
So I'm going to hand things over now to News Collective comrade and Supreme Leader Alex DeBoer.
Okay. Wow, we made that joke on air. Okay, so moving on. All right, so we are now going to go to a short piece. Yesterday, myself and Zoe Powers, another News Collective member, attended the Downtown Eastside Women's Memorial March. So a bit of history to this march. The first Memorial March was held in 1992 in response to the murder of a woman on Powell Street in Vancouver. So out of this sense of hopelessness and anger came an annual march on Valentine's Day, meant to express compassion, community, and caring for all women in Vancouver's Downtown Eastside. Which is on the obviously unceded Coast Salish territories. The Women's Memorial March continues to honor the lives of missing and murdered Indigenous women across Canada. Increasing deaths of many vulnerable women from the Downtown Eastside continue to leave family, friends, loved ones, and community members with an overwhelming sense of grief and loss. And Indigenous women are disproportionately go missing, and there has been criticism with the lack of action to address these tragedies. So right now we're going to play a bit of a collection of voices from a press conference that happened at 11 a.m. at the Carnegie Hall right before the march began at noon. So we're going to go to that now.
Since 1992, the Women's Memorial March takes place in downtown Vancouver, honoring the stolen lives of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls across Canada. This February 14th, a press conference was held at the Carnegie Centre before the march began at noon. Indigenous community organizers spoke. The voices you're about to hear include Robin Aweeder, Carol Martin, Myrna Kramner, and others.
I feel really honored to be part of the Memorial March. I've been part of it for many, many, many years, and it started from a small group of people, and it has grown so large because the more people we educate, the more people we talk about a lot of these issues, the more people are understanding what Indigenous women in particular are dealing with.
27 years is too long. The lack of interest, the lack of support from the police services. 27 years, I think, also shows the strength, you know, of our community, the strength of the women, because it basically started from the women, and we formed together, you know, 27 years ago for justice.
So we, as a committee, make sure that we march and remember and grieve for the loved ones that we've lost, that have been murdered, that have gone missing. You know, and it's so hard. Last year I was sad. This year I'm getting really, really angry. I'm not even talking about the National Enquirer because it's a train wreck. It's a train wreck. So we get together every year and we mourn. We mourn the women that we have lost. I put the list together, and it's not great bedtime reading because we knew so many of these women, and they're gone, you know, they're gone, and there's been no justice.
We knew the women.
We worked with them. We walked with them. We cried with them. We celebrated with them. You know, we had dinners with them. We pulled them up. It's a really tough year because it's ongoing. I'm going to keep speaking about this until I'm freaking in the ground because it's time for us to wake up to realize that there is no justice on stolen land. I'm speechless. I don't know what to say. I'm saddened because before we had the women dying and going missing and murdered, now we have them just dropping dead around us. We're deep in it. What are we going to do about it? We need help here. We need people to stand up and support us. We need people to come forward. We need help. We need the system to change their attitudes and their beliefs and this ingrained ideology about who we are as First Nation women. We need help. Like, who are we going to ask for help? You know, when Canada has failed us for so many years. We need to do something, and we all need to be accountable.
Us women, we will unite, we will stand together, we will stand strong, and we will keep fighting for murdered and missing Indigenous women, for women that are facing systematical injustices. We will not stop, we will only continue, and we will only get stronger.
We have to listen. And listen to us.
This is Democracy Watch. That was our final piece. Thank you so much for tuning in today. This is CITR 101.9 FM. Our next episode will be next Thursday at 5 p.m. as usual. Continue listening for more CITR programming and have a good night.